Welcome to Envision Radio from 1070 AM 98.9 WINA right here in downtown Charlottesville, coming live to you this morning with Price and Lorenzo Dickerson.
So we're back. Robbie's back. I said you haven't been here in 6 weeks. It's only been like two. Yeah.
It's okay. Let's not get crazy.
We can talk about your trip down south a little bit too.
I was on a trip down south.
In an interlude
in the
here.
Deep south. A place that's right. I never wanted to go before, but yes.
Yeah. Well, that's why a lot of us left. But anyway, we're here today with local artist, filmmaker. You've seen his stuff. And if you haven't, you should. Lorenzo Dickerson here, another sort of whip around Charlottesville native we were talking about. We both kind of came up and then left. And now here we are. We're back. Thanks for coming and hanging with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So for the folks who either might not know or haven't really kept up, just, you know, give us kind of the brief synopsis of a little bit of the backstory, and then we'll get into some of the more current stuff.
So I'm originally from Albemarle County, born and raised here. Family's been here for generations. I graduated from Western Albemarle High School, left for a bit, went to North Carolina, was in Maryland, came back home, and for the past several years have been filmmaking, telling the stories of African American history and culture in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and in Virginia as a whole, which a lot of it stems from the stories that I heard from my grandparents growing up, and kind of reaching back and filling in the gaps to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about just how did that start? Right, sort of like where did that sort of artistry, filmmaking, passion thing start? We talked to a couple other people, you know, Clarence and Ty, and everyone's kind of got a little bit of a different door into that. What was yours? How did you what struck you about, like, oh, this is a cool way for me to learn or tell stories or whatever the case may be?
Yeah. So the way that I really got started, my career background is in marketing. So I was telling stories that way. For most of my career, I got started in filmmaking really because I wanted to build out my family tree for my kids. But before I had kids, I wanted them to have it. And my family couldn't really understand the family story. I was traveling back to Charlottesville every weekend and doing research at the courthouse and Library of Virginia and that sort of thing, and finding out these bits and pieces of information.
Right.
And my family couldn't follow the information. So I said, you know what? Why don't I make a film? That way they can watch it from beginning to end. I did that, and you know, I got with Dr. Andrea Douglas over at the African American Heritage Center, and we showed it there, and 140, 150 people showed up. Wow. A lot of those were family members, and they were able to learn the story, and I fell in love with that in that moment, and that's when it kind of clicked with me that these were the stories of my grandparents. Yeah. When I was a child, I used to sit at my grandmother's feet. She used to sit in this like wingback chair and read the Bible. Mm-hmm. So I would sit at her feet and she would tell me these stories of the olden days, is what I call it. And she would tell me all these stories. You know, we lived on a road in the county where the church, the family church is on the road. The old schoolhouse is right next door to that. Mm-hmm. And she would tell me these stories, but they weren't in great detail. You know, you get those, like, I walked to school.
Uphill both ways.
Bits and pieces, right?
So now I'm going back and learning more about these stories and getting the details and talking to others that, you know, that have these types of stories as well that I can learn from.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about, so origin stories are really important. They kind of define who we are in terms of place and the world.
Yeah.
Talk to me about your journey, about why that became important to you, and in the context of being a Black American, knowing that there's not always a trail, right? We can't always trace where it started, where the beginning was for your family in America. So why were you interested in retracing those steps, and what did you discover, as you started to unpack them?
For sure. A lot of it started with where I grew up in Albemarle County, so in a small area that was once called Cobham or Cobham, right near Keswick, on St. John Road, as I mentioned, family homes all up and down this road, the church, the school, that sort of thing. I would ride my bike up and down this road, day in and day out. I would never let my kids ride up and down the road today.
I know.
Yeah, right.
Things are different back then.
Yeah, the traffic and everything. Yeah, it's, I'm afraid.
80s parents just like took the decade off. Like you look at some of this stuff, I'm like, come on.
We rode around in cars in the way back with no seatbelts.
Oh, yeah.
Just exactly. For starters.
For sure.
Right. Yeah.
Remember the station wagon?
No helmets.
You got two people facing the other way, too. Like that was an absolute classic.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We would actually me and my cousins and I, my aunt had a station wagon that with the seat in the back.
Yeah, I remember the seat in the back.
We would fight over who got to sit in that.
And there wasn't even seatbelts in the seat in the back sometimes. You just sat like folded down.
Just a bench in the trunk. Yeah.
Funny.
Definitely. Oh, good. Yeah, and like it was always interesting to me because all the African Americans in that community lived on this one road.
Yeah.
And surrounding this area are these 1,000-acre farms all around, and it was always I was always curious about it, thinking as a young kid, thinking to myself, were we connected to slavery on these properties at some point?
Like at some point that thought was in your mind about what's my relationship to the surrounding community.
Yeah definitely. You have the white church that is around the corner, that is this grand stone building, and then you have the black church. It doesn't look the same at all. And then, you know, of course I knew that my grandmother went to that school and that sort of thing. And as I did more research, it confirmed that yes, my ancestors were enslaved on this property called Castle Hill. And after emancipation, they moved very close by because they continued to work at Castle Hill.
Of course they did, right? Sharecropping.
Yeah, for sure. And the slave owners are buried at that white church, the grand church that's around the corner.
Powerful. Sure. Yeah. I haven't had somebody actually articulate that.
Yeah.
That close in proximity to where your family now lives.
Definitely. Right. Yeah. It was always of interest to me, and just being able to make that connection connects me more to this place.
Yeah.
And then as time goes on, I'm learning. I'm always learning more. So learning that I'm, you know, descendant of enslaved laborers at UVA, as well as Penn Park now, recently finding out.
Okay.
So as the years go by, I'm just constantly connecting myself even further to Albemarle County, to the Charlottesville area.
And it's just, history.
Yeah.
I have to ask one more question.
Go for
it. Back to you.
You got weeks worth of buildup here. I've been flying solo dolo here, so go ahead.
So this idea of descendants has become a theme in the last few years here in Charlottesville. It wasn't prior. You didn't hear much about descendants of slavery, but it's definitely becoming something where descendants are speaking up, becoming vocal, and reclaiming their past and the space for themselves. What do you see your place in that being as a filmmaker?
For me, I feel a responsibility to tell these stories in a way that I feel like I can do in a unique way, just being so local and so connected to the area. I want people to understand those stories, and so that the next time they are driving around Charlottesville or in a certain space, that they think about them a little bit differently. You know, I mentioned Castle Hill a few minutes ago, but Castle Hill is a great example of that, because
when it's not just a cidery where you go out and spend X amount of money at a party,
right?
Or a fundraiser, right?
Definitely.
It has this legacy.
And all of these places that are, you know, that are wineries, a lot of them were slaveholding plantations at some point in time. As you can imagine, you know, a space that large, right, in Albemarle County. Now, a lot of times we don't think about that. We go and we enjoy the space. But hopefully people will think about that. If you go to Castle Hill today for a wedding, a beautiful space, right? But my fourth great uncle, Colin Byrd, was a slave
on that property.
And the coachman at Castle Hill, and he's buried there today and has a headstone.
You can see his headstone
over in the woods away from the house. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Powerful stuff, right?
Yeah. For sure.
And important. All right. I have lots more questions, but I'm going to share. It's good to be back.
So
in the saddle.
So it goes. Right? Enough of me. Enough of my voice. If for some reason you're just joining us, you're listening to Envision from the United Way of Greater Charlottesville, News Radio 98.9, 1070 AM WINA. Price, Lorenzo, and the force of nature that is Ravi Rispetto is back with us in the, I was going to say co-pilot, but I'm very clearly the co-pilot. So in the pilot's chair. So I want to ask you about kind of, you are, so you worked for Albemarle County. Was it Albemarle County Public Schools or was it just the county?
Albemarle County Public Schools.
So you've worked in education.
Yes.
You are married to an educator.
Yes.
You have children of your own, so you're also a father. So what I'm getting at is that in this kind of constellation of things that you are, with the understanding of what is taught in schools and you being a storyteller, how do you feel about whose job is that? Whose job is it to start to tell these stories? Is it the schools? Is it people like you? Is it public-private partnerships? I mean, how do we create an environment where kids, especially kids that look like our kids, mm-hmm. have an opportunity to experience their history? And is the onus on us? Do I have to be like, hey, we got to head down to Vinegar Hill to watch this movie because you're not going to get that in fifth grade? Or is it the kind of thing where, like, you are trying to work with, so you're going to, I'm sort of leading you down this path here, but mm-hmm. if, like, working more with the public schools to be like, look, y'all, I don't, you know, we have to figure out a way to bring this more into kind of a curricular arena. Mm.
Definitely. My feeling on that, honestly, is that, well, for one, it's us as parents, of course.
Sure.
You know, but definitely the school system. The school system has the greatest reach to reach the most kids at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And Albemarle County is just, it's specifically, that's where my experience has been.
Sure.
With the county. It's huge, right?
It's huge.
25 mm-hmm. schools.
Mm-hmm.
A lot bigger than the city.
Yeah.
Now, I will say there are definitely several one-off teachers,
right?
Throughout the city and the county that are interested in teaching their kids
mm-hmm.
this subject matter. And they reach out all the time. So I go into the county schools and the city schools, Charlottesville Day School, and
sure.
gone in and shown films and given talks and help to teach this history, mm-hmm. which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it needs to be done at a central office level,
sure.
at a building principal level. It needs to be woven into the curriculum a lot more so that children are getting this information early,
mm-hmm.
And they don't have to hope to get a particular teacher that just so happens
sure.
to be interested in it,
yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's arbitrary. It just depends on if you get that teacher yeah. that year or not.
And do you think, this is a loaded question, do you think that's possible? Because it seems like, I mean, look at the course of sort of the last 8 years of sort of American history, and mm-hmm. education is now political fodder, right?
Exactly.
What you can say, what you can't, who, you know what I'm saying, who gets to teach what and when and how and uh-huh. why. I mean, and the question is, do you honestly think there's a future where it is something that we as Black parents can rely on from schools, or should we just be like, look, we got to start building our own bridges here because it's not going to happen,
yeah.
right? You know, I've got a 2-year-old, and am I just looking at 3 years out being like, you know what? She ain't getting any of that in public school, so Dad's going to have to start, you know, sort of build the boat for himself, and,
right.
and off we go, you know, right? I mean, we're going to have to start to build, you know, sort of coalitions on our own to do that, or do you think that there is a potential future, right, where it can be done in a way that is, you know, authentic, but also, again, we understand, has to sort of, you know, satisfy the sociocultural zeitgeist.
Exactly. Definitely at this moment in time, it doesn't seem like...
Doesn't look great from right now.
It does not look great at all.
It does not look helpful, folks.
No. it does not look like we're going to be able to rely on the school system as a whole to make that decision, especially not now.
Right.
individual teachers, they have some autonomy to be able to, if they're interested in it, to be able to teach some of this themselves.
Right.
But for it to come down from the top.
Yeah, sure.
Is difficult. And with my experience working in the school system, there's a lot of things that happen, that mm-hmm. occur, that, I mean, that personally I don't agree with.
Yeah.
When it comes to teaching this, you know, this sort of subject. Where the school division will make a certain decision, and I'm standing there baffled.
You're right.
Like, hold on, like, why? Why was that decision made?
Right.
where did the logic come from in order to make that decision? There's a lot of times where it just doesn't make sense.
Sure.
And you can tell that it's a politicized decision that's being made.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, can't we just start with the fact that white teachers were removed from our schools back in the 60s, along with white, you know, or black teachers, rather, and black administrators? Like, I don't think we've done a good job at actually putting people in these spaces that can tell a different story, one. Mm-hmm. And two, to your point, the history is so curated that you're only going to get one version, right, that's been approved.
Exactly.
And so to Price's point, yeah, he absolutely 100% is going to have to put together history for his child if he wants her to really learn. I will tell you, having come back from that trip, 60% of the people that went through the civil rights tour were teachers from local school system, and that's fantastic because that's what we need.
Definitely.
But they were the teachers that already were curious.
Right.
They were the teachers that already were like, I'm reading the stuff they give me, you know, in the books, and I feel like this is not the truth.
Right.
Let me go do some homework on my own, right? So that's great, but that's like 60% of 100 people on one trip once a year, right? So it's not the thing that's going to like shift the whole process. So kind of what you're saying, like, how can people in community start to infuse these stories into the lives of children, and not just children, right? I mean, teens, young adults, but the people that have the opportunity to make change, next generation, if they're not going to get it in school.
Yeah. I think we need to really make these stories more obvious.
Huh.
And that was one of the main reason that Jordi Yeager and I decided in my last film to show the film where we showed it outside at the Jefferson School.
Yep.
several reasons. One, COVID.
Sure.
Right? We wanted to be outside, right?
Sure.
Also, you know, the space and the number of folks that we expected to be there, but it had to be outside in the former Vinegar Hill.
Yeah, right.
Because we wanted people, as they're watching the film, to be like, oh, okay, and be able to turn and say, that's where that was.
Right.
So that the next time they ride by it, they walk past it, they'll think about it a little bit differently. And we felt like being inside with four walls, it changes the perspective completely, and you can't really tell where you are. So that was very deliberate. So with things like that and markers, we did the Alamo 26 markers several years ago.
Yeah.
And placed them where I placed them for that reason, because I wanted students, as they walk into the school, to see that first, to really understand that story, but also to give a physical
symbol
thing for teachers in the building to say, oh, I can teach from this.
Yeah.
Like, now it's right in front of me.
Right.
I know where it is.
I have proximity.
Exactly.
It's
right.
Proximity to a symbol, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I don't put it right in front of you, then you'll go on and do something different.
But
you need to be able to see it, and it'll help you make that decision whether you want to teach from it or not.
Yeah. How do you choose subject matter, right? And just, you know, knowing and looking at the things that you have done, how do you, as an artist, decide what stories to tell, right? And I think most primarily, and I think sort of connecting these conversations, the Paramount thing is so interesting to me, because take a straw poll in the downtown mall of people who have been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do you think knew that there was a Third Street entrance? You probably know. I mean, you probably ask people.
2%, maybe.
Right.
People who not people who are passing by. People
black
who have
and
lived
white
here.
People. I would argue black people don't.
There's a lot of them, but like people. That's what we're talking about, right? Is that like it's not like you're just ordained with black just information.
Knowledge.
If you can grow up here black and nobody's told you anything, because you're taking the same tours, you're walking the same walks, you've done the same. Been
to
Monticello 600 times.
Paramount doesn't feel like a place for you. You do know that.
Well, no, for sure.
Right?
But you walk by that every day. You've gone to it. You've done it. So this is part of that storytelling arc, right? Back to the question of like, how did you decide on that? Or even, you know, in the Vinegar Hill story, again, it's a different spin on a story that I think people often like mention. That's kind of like the thing,
exactly.
You know, it's like, oh, Vinegar Hill. And they're like, okay, boom. You know, like I've heard of that thing or whatever. There was a theater there.
It's very impersonal. They leveled Vinegar Hill. They moved the people to 10th and Page.
And
it was upsetting,
but
moved on.
Yeah.
Like,
And so like, through the arc of sort of what you've done and the stories you've told, I mean, you know, how have you, because there's a lot of it, right? There's a lot of it, you know? So how have you decided at any given moment, you know, okay, this is one that one, either, is it because they aren't told enough? Is it because it just sort of fits kind of what you do well? I mean, how does that whole thing work for you?
First, I love how you mentioned you've been to Monticello 600 times. That is so true.
Every school field trip you grew for up the here. Entire day.
Yeah. Jamestown, yeah. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Right.
Nobody
yeah.
talks about the slaves or the American Indians.
No,
right?
No, 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 no,
the settlers.
No, no, they discovered they a new world where people already were.
Right. The school system loves yeah. Monticello.
Oh,
right?
Lord. Jeez. Mercy. Yeah. 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 He was, what do they say? Conflicted. That's right. That's how far they've gotten now. He was conflicted.
Definitely.
Well, they named the schools after all these right. people, right? Robert E. Lee High School. I mean, let's
yeah.
be honest.
Yeah. There's a couple of those. Yeah.
I think for me, it's the stories that move me. I feel like if they move me, and if I'm interested, if I have an aha moment and say, oh, I didn't know that, like, yeah. hold on, then I'm like, okay, a whole lot of other people have never heard this story as well.
Sure.
And as time goes on, as you know, all of my grandparents have passed at this point, and they were, you know, born in the 30s.
Yeah.
So as these people pass on, those are the folks who actually lived
sure.
these stories.
Experiences.
Yeah.
And we lose them.
So one, we have the elders in the community passing, but then we also have Charlottesville not being the same Charlottesville it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Sure.
It's grown so much, and so many people live here now that aren't from here.
Okay, sure.
So it's very easy to not know any of this history. Whether you're from Charlottesville or not, based on, you know, not being from here or just being young enough generationally where, you know, your grandparent is not someone who was born in the 30s that lived these types of stories. So even a lot of times if you're African American and you are 15 years old, 18 years old, you're in high school, a lot of times you haven't heard any of these stories. You might not have someone old enough in your family that's still around to be able to share those stories with you. Or even if you do, you might not have a relationship with them, you know, black or white, to be able to, you know, people don't sit around and tell stories like that anymore.
Right.
So I think those are important things to me. When I came up with the idea for the Third Street film, the Paramount.
Yeah.
As I was growing up, my father used to always tell me about going to the Paramount as a child. My grandmother would take him there, and they would sit in the balcony. And he would watch, his favorite movie was Shane.
Okay.
It's a Western. I've seen it a trillion times. Like he played it for me a million times growing up. But he never mentioned that it was segregated. He just said they sat in the balcony.
Right.
So growing up, I just figured, oh, you just sat in the balcony, right?
Yeah, higher ground.
Didn't occur to you. Yeah.
So when I was doing Leadership Charlottesville, we took a tour of the Paramount, and now we're sitting in the balcony, and they're telling us about a little bit about the history, and they briefly mention, you know, that was a segregated entrance. They don't really use it anymore other than as an exit.
Right.
And they're in the process now of trying to figure that out, of how to be able to actually take tickets on that side. But I reached out to them and said, hey, let's tell a fuller story. Let me help you put together a full story. And we really, because they mentioned they want to tell the story about that interest, but just didn't know how.
Sure.
Yeah, to contextualize it.
Yeah.
And and reckoning around it. Like, it was wrong. Being honest about what happened and why it happened, and then what they're doing now, more importantly, to change that legacy.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
To make it more inclusive and inviting for all the members of the community, right?
Right.
Through programming, as an example.
Exactly.
Right? Interesting.
Sure.
So I'm just curious, you know, a lot of strength and a sense of well-being comes from knowing your community. And so I'll talk to Ella Jordan on our team, grew up in Esmond. She talks about her childhood. Robert Gray grew up in the same area. He talks about his childhood. They talk about really warm, you know, childhood where they felt surrounded by a support system that was committed to them thriving. They will tell you, we didn't realize we were poor.
Right.
Because what we had was so much greater than the money part, the resources of community. Made us who we are today, right?
Yeah.
Successful people here in our community, successful Black people. So community matters, right? Whether it be a poor community, it matters. How important it is for folks to understand where those pockets of community were here. I mean, what does that mean to somebody to understand, if that's their history, that there are communities of strength here, and they were thriving in the ways that they could. How important is that to the sort of legacy of the Charlottesville Albemarle community?
Yeah, I mean, people really, they need to understand where these communities were, that they were thriving, and where folks are coming from generationally. Yeah. So a lot of times I go to schools and talk to students, and I'm often back at Western Albemarle High School where I went to high school. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we talk about, with teachers in particular, mm-hmm. about the family surnames, those mm-hmm. families that are still in the community, and therefore, you know, you have one student coming in and you have to understand where that student is mm-hmm. when they come in.
Right.
What type of experience did their parent or grandparent yeah. have, mm-hmm. and how that student is bringing that experience,
that legacy with them into the classroom.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's very different if you're growing up in West Haven than if you're growing up in Esmont. You know, there's a sense of empowerment in one community and maybe disempowerment in another. Like, how does that influence or impact a person and their legacy, right?
Yeah, it's definitely important to understand people's background and where they're coming from, for sure.
Is that part of, like, your vision in terms of the filmmaking that you're doing, is to kind of dig into what those communities were here in the community, or that existed historically, and how they got going, and kind of like you described Castle Hill?
Definitely. Yeah. And I want the folks that grew up in those neighborhoods to be able to, in these films, to be able to tell their own story,
yeah.
And share what those experiences were like, because only they can tell those stories and tell them properly.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about when you're making things, like, who is it for, right? So you said you made your first one essentially for your family, right? This mm-hmm. was sort of a way to explain some of this to your family. As you make some of this stuff, do you ever, and the answer might be no, but do you think about, this is going to land with the sort of liberal white Charlottesville intelligentsia, and it's going to help them understand da-da-da-da-da? Or is it like, this is really for, you know, people that look like me and my kids, and it's about empowerment, and I don't really care if you like it or get it, or even, you know what I'm saying? Is there kind of a, different, or do you have a vibe of like, look, this is really about me and us, or is it kind of like, I'm trying to make policy change? Because they can be two different things, right? Because
yeah.
they're sort of like, if you're like, hey, we got to get people on board here, that's yeah. one thing, and that sounds like a thing, and it looks like a thing, and there's one way to do that, right? Or there's kind of the, like, edge toward, you know, kind of the Spike Lee variety of, like, I'm just going to punch you in the mouth with this, and it's not for you, and if you can't get on board, that's fine, because the train's leaving. This
right.
is for us, right? Yeah. Do you have, like, a thought about that, or are you just kind of like, look, I make stuff that I want to be honest and cool, and people will come to it as they are? Like, you know, what is your kind of theory of creativity in that sense?
Yeah. So I think for me, it's twofold. Mm-hmm. Jordy Yeager, he always says this, that when I make films, I have a way of laying the facts out there and allowing you to make up your mind.
Sure.
And it's done like that on purpose, really.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that people get it. If I put the facts out there, I don't necessarily have to say, this is what you need to do with it.
Okay.
I feel like people understand, oh, okay, I got that. He made it, you know, plainly clear for us as to what that history yeah. was, how it relates to today. So hopefully that will influence policy change, mm-hmm. behavior change, allow people to have new experiences just by putting the raw facts out there that can't be argued.
Mm-hmm.
These are historical facts.
Well, people will find a way.
Of course. Exactly. Now, as far as who the audience is, and who I make the films for, to be honest, the only the only folks that I'm really concerned about and I want to make sure that they enjoy the film are the elders in the community.
Huh.
If there's certain folks in this community, they come to me and they say, well done, I'm good.
Really?
Yeah. Like that's, and because there are always going to be some, there's always going to be people that are sure. like, why didn't you do this way?
Sure.
Why you know, why didn't you talk to this? Of course, you know, we can't talk to everybody.
Right.
You watching the film for five
seconds. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
But as long as the elders come and they say, good job, that's all I need.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
So how important is for you to tell the story of Black culture in your filmmaking? And in place, right? It's this community, but it's different than white culture, right? And I think one of the struggles that certainly at Western kids face if you're Black is you try to assimilate into the white culture so you can fit in. That's normal high school. Mm-hmm. But how do we, how do you think about like building pride and understanding and strength in Black culture through your filmmaking?
Yeah, that's something that's super important to me, as you mentioned. Yeah. Being a student at Western, I was blessed to be, you know, luckily I didn't go to Western and Western was in some other place, right, where I wasn't originally from. So me going to Western and, you know, being one of the few African-American students there, especially starting my senior year.
That's so wild, though, that also, just for context, that's 1999. That's not the 70s or the 80s.
Correct.
That's 1999.
Right.
Yes, for context.
Yeah. And it's gotten marginally better.
20 right. some years
it's
ago.
It's like tripled, and there's five.
It's still probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Just in case you thought this was like years, this was like right after integration. Like, this is 1999.
Recently. Yeah. For sure. It's, you know, it's being one of the few African Americans, but being very strongly connected to your African American family and the community changed things for me. So
that's why I keep asking about community. I think community, Black community strengthens Black culture, helps build pride and a sense of belonging and well-being, even in white spaces.
Yeah. So for me, it made it okay being at Western at that time. At the time, I didn't think I recognized it.
Right.
When I was in the fifth grade, there were two African Americans in the fifth grade, Murray Elementary School.
would be about right.
91. I went back in 2015 for their graduation. There was one. So when I was there, it was myself and a first cousin of mine.
Like both from the same family.
From the same family, literally the community.
That almost
that makes
doesn't
sense.
Count.
That
that's right. that's like still one.
In 2015. It was my cousin's daughter.
Come on.
That is the one person.
Yes. Really?
That's why we're having this. So that's why this conversation is important for people to understand the context of our community.
And
we're still segregated in many ways. Let's be honest.
Definitely. Yeah, and like, we're talking about.
Wait, so 26 years later, one family is accounting for 100% of the Black population?
Correct. Same family.
Yeah. And a lot of times, like, people who live in that area today, because the neighborhood doesn't look like it used to whatsoever, right?
Yeah,
there are
a lot
of African-Americans living on Morgantown Road, right where the Murray Elementary School is. A lot of people, even if you go there now, don't realize that that used to be a Black school that my mother attended when it was segregated.
I would say most people don't realize that history. That's why I'm getting down to back to this history of our own culture and the history of our community and what really happened.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And because the children realize that was a Black school, there's a certain power and pride that goes with that, right? But how many of the two kids that went there that were Black actually knew that that was part of the history?
Right. And it goes, it continues, right? Like when I was at Western, there were a decent number of African-American students because you got part of the students that went to Walton. And
It pulled in,
That's right, because before Monticello.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's right.
It pulled in.
That's right.
First day of school, my senior year, 98. Monticello is now open, and you walk into school, and it's like, hey, what happened?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Where did we go?
Right.
Yeah.
We're back to being at Henley again, right? Just us few. But it was so obvious to us at that point. So it's always been, you know, being highly connected to the African-American community is super important. I feel like if I wasn't, things would be a little bit different for
you. Probably wouldn't be who you are today, right?
No.
You're telling these stories from a place of strength, right?
Right.
And really trying to share that with other people.
Exactly.
They can feel the same thing and the same pride and the same understanding, right?
Definitely wouldn't be the same person.
Yeah.
As a, I'm going to ask you a question as a dad to dad. What is your sort of take on this theory of kind of assimilation to play the game because the game has rules versus trying to take up space and change the rules, right? As we go through, you know, talking about putting kids in schools and having experiences and being in predominantly white spaces, most likely, you know, how do you feel about, you know, have you thought about that? Do you conceptualize that where like you and I both understand that like there are rules to games to get in certain rooms, you know what I'm saying? And sort of how apt are you to play by those rules? Or are you willing to be like, look, I'm probably going to handicap myself, but I just can't stomach that, right? I can only code switch to a certain point. I can't, you know what I'm saying? Like, and then think about that with us, but then as parents being like, how does that net out to our kids? Are we just kind of be like, look, you kind of got to get in, or, you know, are you more of a like, no, forget it. Like, you know, I'm going to make sure my kids have all of this stuff and all of this back stuff. And I'm going to come pick you up from the principal's office once a month because that's just what is more important to me.
Right. I think for me, assimilating today is different than say when I was a teenager. I feel like I know and understand more today than I did when I was at Western, and I was in high school. I recognized being one of the few, but it didn't.
It's just what it was. Yeah,
didn't bother me at all. I didn't even really think.
You didn't question it. You're just like, this is just my normal.
Yeah, didn't question it.
I spend my life in white spaces. I'm used to it.
Right. Yeah. And even, you know, into my 20s and whatnot, my wife and I would talk about it.
Like, yeah.
But and I'm like, you know.
Well, and she's got what 95 degrees from Chapel Hill and UVA, so it's not like she's rolling in a lot of places with a whole bunch of black people, right? Like, you know,
like I'm in a restaurant and I'm like the only black person there, and and at the time, I paying attention to it or whatever. Now it's a little bit different. I'm definitely paying greater attention for myself, but also I have two black sons. And you know, fully aware of what America and this world is for them.
And what they look like to it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Without them having a chance to become who they're going to be.
Right.
So I guess my question revolves around, you make a good point, because the harder part of this question, I guess the rougher edge, is that I think that all of us as black parents want our kids to be fully who they are and be allowed to be who they are. And that's what we want. If we understand that that's not possible, I have a daughter, so it's different for her. But for you, it is more of a very literal life and death conversation at some point, right? Like, this is legitimately dangerous to your well-being. It's not just like, oh, you might not get a job or you might take a lower salary. It's like, you might get shot.
Right.
You know, is that something that, how old are they?
They're 10 and 7.
So they're creeping into that stage where, you know, we's like, oh, that kid's dangerous. I'm like, that dude's 12.
Yeah.
He's not dangerous.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, so is that sort of creeping up on you now? Are you, is that a thing that you're starting to think about? Have you, let me ask you this. Have you had the talk yet?
Oh, plenty of times.
10 and 7.
Plenty of times.
10 and 7.
Yeah, yes. Definitely had the talk.
Plenty of times. And we travel a lot. It's always on our minds. When we're going outside of this community.
Yeah.
It's one thing even inside this community.
Sure.
But then when you're traveling to some place that you don't know.
Yeah, it's unsafe.
Especially now because people know you, right? So you know, I mean, it's true though, right? And Charlottesville, like, you know, they will get some credit for knowing you, and you've been obviously a huge part of this community. So I think that you at least have a little bit of an insulated ability here to be like, oh, you're his kids by nature of, you know, oh, I know him. He's one of the good ones, right? You know, I'm sure you'll get some of that. But right, yeah, I mean, if you want to go down.
Safe.
Yeah, for sure.
The word is safe.
Yeah. For sure, yeah. And you want to go down to the Outer Banks, you got to drive through Danville. You better be going 30 miles an hour with your hands out the window. Like,
right. Yes.
You know, so
right.
Yeah.
We're paying attention. My kids are like, they're pointing out when they see a giant Confederate flag on the side of the interstate.
Yeah.
You know, when you're traveling and you're black, it makes me think of like, you know, the Green Book,
yeah.
Something like that, right?
Yeah, where do you feel safe and welcome?
Yeah, I'm not stopping here. I'm not going to the bathroom here. Get out of here.
It's 2022, you and your seven-year-old is like, I have to use the bathroom. And you're like, oh, no.
No, you don't.
But stop when I get off on 95, yeah.
You don't.
Can you just hold it just for a little while longer so I can get to a populated
place? You got
place.
30 miles, yeah.
Right. To a big Wawa.
Yep. Right. I need to get out of 1945 before
oh,
we can
God,
go to bed.
So bad.
Yeah. I just want to talk about this. I mean,
we're gonna fight for questions. We're like, yeah, it's almost over.
You know, have they vocalized at all that their experience, right? Like, to you in that regard? I mean, because they're at that age where obviously they notice stuff and they're starting to put the pieces together. I mean, is that a thing that they have, or that you feel like they have been able to express and that they're comfortable expressing? Because I think some of that, and I think like you and me and a lot of us, we grow up, you just internalize stuff, right? And then I think that kind of like, you know, who's it, Aristotle, whoever's like, you are what you consistently do. So you internalize those things. And then, you know, I had some of my aha moments later in life, really at Montpelier, when I'm, you know, I've read the Constitution, I'm going, what in the hell? Like, then things start to fit, you know? And I think
been placed on your life. In
the, well, I just think my whole thing is like, I wish it had clicked for me earlier. Right. I think I wish as an adult now, in hindsight, I would have had some of those moments earlier. I don't know that it would have really changed a lot, but I just think I'm like, man, this would have been good to know at 15, 16, 17, because, you know, you start to sort of reflect on, like, I was confused about why certain things would happen and fit a certain way. And it's pretty linear.
It's designed that way, but you don't always learn it when you're
Yeah. And so, you know, for them, do you think that's a thing that it's starting to click for them and they've kind of, you know, understand kind of, you know, who they are and who they are reflexively?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's funny, even more so possibly for my 7-year-old than my 10-year-old.
Interesting.
Just for personality reasons. Okay. So my 10-year-old is a more reserved, more quiet child.
Okay.
My 7-year-old is not quiet at all.
Out there.
He will say anything and everything. But both of them, they recognize things. They will vocalize it and tell it to myself and my wife. I think another thing is that, so the work that their parents do, right, I think takes a role as well.
For sure.
My wife teaches at the School of Government at UNC, and she does DEI work there. So they hear conversations.
Sure.
And even when I'm editing a film, you know, my 7-year-old or my 10-year-old, they're standing there and they're like, because, you know, you start running these clips over and over.
Sure.
And they're listening.
Yeah, they're listening and they're watching. They don't have any great grandparents that are still living, but they're watching these folks on screen and they recognize it. So by the time, you know, by the time Raised came out, they had seen most of the film. And my 7-year-old would come in the room where I'm at, and he's like, "Oh, is that Raised? Are you?" He's sitting there listening to, you know,
Dad, mix the audio better. All right,
kids watch way more than they listen. I mean, we can lecture and tell them, and having a 24-year-old, 19, they watch what we do, and that's how they model and become who they're going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. You can tell them something 1,000 times. They're going to watch what you do every single time. Yeah,
definitely.
It's interesting. I was just going to say two things. Do you feel that your films are about activism at all, or not really? Because I heard you say they're really for the elders and sort of a respect and honor thing, right, around legacy and history.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an element of activism in your filmmaking? And two, when we talk about origin stories, how important is it to you to really trace it back all the way, pre-slavery, like transatlantic slave trade? Like, where did we come originally from? Like, where is our country of origin?
Yeah.
Is that part of your process when you're thinking about this legacy and history?
For sure. As far as activism concerned, there's definitely an activism element to all of the films. Mm-hmm. You know, activism is action. Mm-hmm. And the hope is that when you finish watching one of these films, that you'll want to take action in some way that makes sense for you. You may not be the decision maker that can change a whole lot of things, right? There may be a group of people that need to do that. It may be, you know, city council or board of supervisors or school board or whatever. But just you in your daily life, hopefully getting this information will allow you at the end of it to say, okay, I'm going to change this one thing about, even if it's just about yourself and how you perceive other people. And then your second question.
Just about the legacy piece. How important is it to go all the way back? Like, not just here in America, but prior to America in terms of telling the story.
Definitely important. Important for African Americans, but also everyone to understand that African American history does not start with slavery.
Correct. They were thriving communities in Africa, on the west coast of Africa, and people were, you know, they were trafficked.
Yeah.
to America.
For sure.
That story, I don't think people really just say, oh, slavery. Like, they're not even thinking about, that's not the history of our people.
Yeah.
That was done to our people. It doesn't define our people, right?
Yeah. People really, it's very easy, whether it be films and other media, it's easy, it's very easy to think Black history starts with slavery because that's often where we start.
Sure.
Right. Where we start the story.
Right.
I had a history teacher when I was in high school, white history teacher. I'm in class. We're learning about slavery. And she turns and says, Lorenzo, what was that like?
Oh, my gosh. Boy, I hope we've come somewhere from that point.
I looked at her and I said, I don't know. I wasn't there.
Lady, I'm 16.
I'm just trying to go to prom. Like, what are you talking to me for?
Like, 1997. Yeah. Like, what are you thinking?
So trying to get a, hit the Fruit Works machine. What are we talking about?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's that definitely happens. You know, I've traced some of my lineage further back.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't made a film about it yet.
I surely hope you do.
That could
we need to tell those stories, like the stories of thriving communities and origin country and how people were stolen and trafficked from their country. Yeah. And yes, slavery happened, horrendous. Mm-hmm. It's amazing that any Black person survived to today when you hear about what really happened to people.
Exactly.
The resilience required and intelligence and strength and all the things.
Yeah.
We don't typically tell that story. We talk about slaves.
Right.
But what people went through to be here today is pretty incredible. But yeah, that origin story, you just don't hear that very often.
It's
like it all started on the ship somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
If you're African American in this country today, it's a miracle that you are here.
Period. Living and breathing and walking on the soil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
One last one for you. An
just
award
a low-key
you won
interview
in,
this morning.
Yeah, right. An award you won in 2019 from the Chamber, Community Leadership Award from the Chamber of Commerce and Leadership Charles. Well, yeah, I want to ask you about this as someone
it's all the sheet.
You know, I think that artists to a degree, at some level, you know, have the art, and then there's the recognition for said art. You know, and you've mentioned that you know the buy-in from community members and elders is important. Is this, I mean, when you win an award like that, is it the kind of thing where you're like, all right, cool? Or is that, you know, is that a big deal? And I don't mean that to like sound grotesque. I think there's just some people that are like, I don't really care. Like, I'd like to make stuff and I think it's good and other people thought it was good and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is that a thing from a town you grew up in for, you know, a town you're raising your kids in? I mean, does that mean more? And is that the kind of thing that helps you sort of gain momentum to like, you know, does it inform then? The next thing and the next, you know, stuff as you start to put it together.
For sure. I mean, that award, definitely the Community Leadership Award, it definitely meant something to me, specifically because it was focused on community.
Mm-hmm.
It showed me that I was going down the right path.
Yeah, okay.
And that it's the work is resonating mm-hmm. with the community, but also the whole process of how that came about. You know, the award came from the work in the community that's been done, but also, you know, through the process of Leadership Charlottesville, at that time I was able to, you know, at the end of that program, you create these programs, these projects, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the project that I led was a community leadership program for high school students
mm-hmm.
at Albemarle High School. So that was one thing, but then like the process of creating that, the team that I had was also just, it was interesting, it was community focused. My best friend from high school that I was roommates with in college, mm-hmm. at Lynchburg College, hadn't seen him in 15 years.
Yeah.
We go into this Leadership Charlottesville, the very first meeting that we have, and there he is. And he's on this team that I have creating this program for these high school students.
Right.
There's someone else that went to Charlottesville High School at the same time that I hadn't seen in forever. And,
wow.
And she's on this team. And we're all, you know, we stay in touch and which is great. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was a team effort from folks that are from here, from here.
Yeah, yeah.
All came together. It was just a great experience.
Yeah.
Itself. Yeah.
That's okay. Great. You good?
I feel like I got to go run the United Way.
You got to. Oh, yeah, you do that.
Got the day job.
Yeah, no, you do.
Just a little something. You know.
some of that. You're Let's get out of here before I end up with more work to do. Big thanks to Lorenzo again for coming down and hanging out with us. If you have ideas for the show, people we should talk to, check us out on social, all platforms at United Way Seville. The inbox is open, envision@unitedwayseville.org. Big thanks again to Kat for supporting us on the show, and make sure you check us out on whatever audio platform people listen to podcasts on these days. How do people keep up with you? And two-part question. One, how do people keep up with you, and is there any – are you going to toss a teaser out there, like what's next? Like when, you know, when do we keep an eye out for the next film? What's going on?
Yeah, so if you go to moppintown.com, M-A-U-P-I-N-T-O-W-N, you can get, you know, all the information. You can even watch Raised online there, with, you know, through VPM. As far as projects that are coming, Deliverance, the story of Henry Box Brown, is a short film that's geared towards elementary school students, and that will be coming out at the end of the summer, getting just ready for the new school year. And also the Race and Sports Oral History Project that I'm doing with the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society. So that's about 60 to 70 interviews of folks that went to Lane, Burley, and Albemarle High School in the 50s, 60s, and probably will be a film that'll come out of that at some point.
There you go. Great. There you have it. What is it? Moppintown.com?
Moppintown.com.
Moppintown.com. Stay tuned the rest of the summer. Go watch Grays if you haven't. Do yourself a favor. And again, 65 other episodes of me and Robbie fighting in a radio booth. Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora, wherever you guys get your podcasts. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see if she shows up again next week, though. It's sort of hit or miss, right? Big thanks, Lorenzo. We'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.